Hello, and welcome to The Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's date is Thursday, the 12th of March. We're going to be looking at Horatio Nelson today and the Battle of Trafalgar. And this was originally broadcast as part of a segment on Aryan Britannia back in October last year. I do believe it's the anniversary of Trafalgar today, Max. Is that correct?
It is, yes. It's the anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar, which took place on the 21st of October 1805. And I thought that it was a significant date today because of the fact that we've been talking about Great Britons in our previous broadcasts. And, of course, the Great Britain who performed and won the day during the Battle of Trafalgar was Lord Nelson. And I thought it would be a fitting tribute to him for us to discuss the Battle of Trafalgar today on the programme. And I mean, Nelson had distinguished himself as a sailor long before the Battle of Trafalgar, and he had suffered various injuries and things, the loss of an eye and one of his arms. And but he was established as a as an admiral of the fleet around about towards the end of the 18th century, and this was, of course, the period of the Napoleonic Wars. And what had happened is that during the Napoleonic Wars, Nelson had distinguished himself at the Battle of the Nile, where he faced an arch rival who was an Admiral Villeneuve in the French Navy. What had happened is that in the intervening years beyond that, that Napoleon had started to establish himself as the dominant force on the European mainland, and Britain was part of the alliance that was opposing the expansion of French power, Napoleon had decided that he was going to invade Britain, and he had massed an army just near the Straits of Dover, near Boulogne. And he was intent then on creating a flotilla of ships that could carry that army across to the south coast of England. And he had plans to drive the English warships that were currently guarding the English Channel out of the channels in order to facilitate that invasion. And so he had instructed Admiral Villeneuve to bring the French fleet together. Admiral Villeneuve at the time had been blockaded into the harbour of Toulon, which is in the Mediterranean, and there was Nelson was actually leading a fleet of British ships that were blockading that port to prevent Villeneuve from getting out. But also the French also had another fleet that was located in Brest in Brittany, which again was being blockaded and prevented from coming out. There were British fleets that were blockading the major ports of Spain, and Spain was an ally of France at the time. So Napoleon's plan was that Villeneuve should break out of the blockade at Toulon, should then sail out through the Straits of Gibraltar, should unite with the Spanish Navy that was currently in Cadiz, and to then sail to the Caribbean, where they were going to pick up other ships and things, and then come back across the Atlantic to relieve the blockade of Brest, to sail into the English Channel, to drive the Royal Naval ships out of the Channel so that the flotilla could then go across and invade England. And what happened, though, was that initially, a British fleet was sent down to Cadiz to maintain the blockade there, and Nelson had just returned to Britain from other ventures that he'd been involved in. The Victory had been refitted, and he then sailed down to Cadiz, where he then took control of the fleet that we were slowly amassing just in the Atlantic off the coast of Spain near Cadiz. And Villeneuve had sailed across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, had picked up the ships and, that he needed there, and with a combined fleet that was composed of both Spanish and French ships, he then sailed back across the Atlantic, but sailed back to Cadiz, and rather than going north to Brest, where he had originally been instructed to go, he then received fresh orders from Napoleon that he was to make his way up to, initially to back round to Toulon and to drop off some troops there, but ultimately with the intention of coming back round and going back into the English Channel, as I'd already explained. But Nelson then chose to intervene. And what had happened was that Villeneuve had broken out of the blockade at Cadiz and was sailing north, and had his ships in a fairly sort of irregular crescent-shaped pattern, which basically wasn't, strictly speaking, the way in which they should have sailed. The tactic in those days was that it was for a fleet to sail in line so that they could then pass the ships of the enemy who would be sailing in line in the opposite direction, and they would like pass together on parallel routes but in different directions, firing at each other, firing broadsides as they would go. That was the conventional way in which a sea battle would be fought, but his ships were manned by sailors who weren't as well trained as they should be, and so the formation was a bit ragged. But what Nelson chose to do, rather than stick to the conventional mode of battle, he swung his forces round at 90 degrees and then attacked the French line sort of perpendicular to their line of travel, so that and in two columns, so that one column broke the French line into two, and another column then broke the French and Spanish line into three. And what happened was that they broke them at roughly the sort of the halfway point initially, so that half of the French fleet was left sailing north, and then the second column of British ships broke the part that had been detached into two pieces, and the French and Spanish ships were then encircled. In the battle that then proceeded, this sort of trailing part that had been detached from the vanguard were then surrounded and were effectively either destroyed or captured. And so that was a very successful tactic. And but by the time the vanguard of the ships had of the French and Spanish ships had managed to turn and come back again, the battle was pretty much over, and they were then faced in a situation where they were outnumbered by the British ships, and after a short engagement, they then decided to depart. And I think only 11 of the Spanish and French ships actually made it back to Cadiz harbour, and all the rest were either captured or they were chased across the seas, and lots of them were sunk, a lot of them were scuttled, quite a lot of them were captured, and it was a really glorious victory for the British fleet that was massively outnumbered. But significantly outnumbered by the French and the Spanish forces. So if we have a look at the forces that were available to Villeneuve, he had 33 ships of the line. And a ship of the line was basically a large battleship of the sort that would have rows and rows of cannons along either side of its superstructure. And a ship of the line would, a first-rate ship of the line would have something like 120 guns. A second-rate ship of the line would have around about 100 guns. And there were third-rates that had about 80, and fourth-rates that had around about 70 guns. And so these were ships that had a formidable amount of firepower. And enemy had something like 30,000 men, and in total around about 2,500 guns. And they were opposed by Napoleon with only 27 ships, with only 17,000 men and 2,148 guns. But because of the unusual tactics employed by Nelson, the French and the Spanish were defeated, and it was a victory that prevented Napoleon from invading Britain, because the army that he'd amassed in northern France, he then turned and marched into Germany and had further battles that secured his dominance of the continent thereafter. But it prevented Napoleon from invading Britain, and Nelson, sadly, was shot during the Battle of Trafalgar and died of his wounds. But such was the great victory that he had secured that his body was preserved in a barrel of brandy, and he was then taken back to Britain for a hero's funeral. And our country is littered with monuments to Nelson, the most famous of which obviously is Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square, but there are other similar columns. There's another one in Great Yarmouth. There's another monument in Southampton. There are monuments in, Liverpool and other places. I can't remember all of the locations now. But as I say, the country is littered with monuments to Nelson, and he was hailed a national hero. And I think that the achievements of a man like him are in keeping with the achievements that we've spoken about before with the other characters that we've celebrated. And I think that it's fitting that on this day, the 21st of October, that we should encourage our people to remember Nelson and his achievements and celebrate them so that we can face the future with greater fortitude.
So it was unconventional warfare, basically, that saved the day. Did that become a staple of naval warfare after that, or was it just of use at that one particular time? Because the enemy's fleet weren't so regimented as they normally would be, with having these ships coming from Gadir's that weren't so well trained. Was it a manoeuvre that then became used by the Navy again, do you know?
I'm not sure whether it was ever used again, but I mean, I would imagine it probably would have done, but it did carry with it considerable risks, because for quite some considerable time before the British ships were able to actually engage the French and the Spanish ships, they had to sail towards the broadsides of the enemy ships. And of course, it would take them quite some time to actually reach, because obviously they were wind-powered ships. It'd take them some time, and the Spanish and French ships were releasing broadsides of cannon fire at the British ships that were approaching. But of course, the British ships were approaching them end-on, and so they presented a smaller target, but they only had a very few guns pointing forward on the ships in those days, and so each broadside was only being responded to by sporadic cannon fire from the British ships. And it could have been a disaster if the broadsides from the Spanish and French ships had been sufficient to sink the leading Royal Naval ships before they'd actually managed to reach the enemy. But as luck would have it, the sea at that particular time was fairly rough. And so that then meant that with the ships, I can't think what the term is for it now, with a yee-yaw to a certain extent as a result of the movement of the waves, it then meant that the accuracy of the French and Spanish gunners was hindered, and so therefore the British ships managed to reach and engage them largely unscathed. I think there was just one of the British battleships that had all of its masts shot off by the point it actually reached the Spanish and the French. But the sailors on board still continued to return fire, etc. And the effect of the two lines of Royal Naval ships piercing the line of the Spanish ships was to then leave the vanguard of the Spanish ships, the ones that were right at the front, to leave them to just sail away where they couldn't actually fire at anybody, and then have to turn round. And because it was, although it was a fairly sort of choppy sea, apparently it wasn't, the wind wasn't particularly strong, or it wasn't in the right direction. So it slowed the ability of the leading ships to turn round, to come back to sort of assist the ones that had been cut off. And the ones that were in the middle and the latter part of the French and Spanish line, they had obviously been divided into two smaller groups, and they were then encircled by the British ships that then released lots of broadsides into them and severely damaged them, and to good effect. And as I said, before the vanguard of the French and Spanish ships was able to return, that the battle was, you know, all but over at that point. And so the tactic had been very, very successful indeed. And I think I've got a list here of the damage and the losses, and it's recorded that the British losses were 458 men dead and 1,208 wounded, but with no ships lost. Whereas the French and the Spanish losses totaled 4,395 dead, 2,500 wounded, 7,500 captured, and with one ship sunk and 22 other ships captured. And of course, that the way the ships were captured in those days was that the two ships would eventually come side to side, firing broadsides of cannon fire at each other, and then grappling hooks would be used to hook onto the enemy ship and pull it so that they were. The ships were, the hulls were, came together, and then marines would invade from the attacking ship onto the defending ship, and there would be hand-to-hand fighting that would eventually, that one side would eventually emerge the winner of, and they would then have successfully captured that ship. And part of the problem that the French and the Spanish had was that during the French Revolution, which was only about 15 years beforehand, a very large number of the most experienced French naval officers had been either executed or sacked from the positions that they previously held. And so the French Navy was commanded by inexperienced officers, and lots of the French naval ratings had very little proper training, particularly in gunnery, and so they were inferior in terms of their ability as warfaring sailors to the British sailors.
That's amazing when you think about it. What went on in this marine warfare. I was thinking you were going to say then that because they'd accepted the defeat, the grappling hooks would go over and then they'd just drag the ship along behind them. I didn't realize the marines were going to jump on board and it would be hand-to-hand fighting right through till the bitter end. And then you think about the skill that's involved with getting these winds right. In looking into Captain Cook and Captain Bligh, particularly Captain Bligh last week, and finding out about these trade winds. You know, there's winds that they can pretty much guess that there's going to be a certain wind in a certain direction all the time in a certain place in the ocean. And then you have to get yourself to that place in the ocean by navigating by the stars or whatever. Again, a skill which white men have developed over thousands of years. So you get yourself in the right position. And then you know that you've got your wind that's going to be taking you, but then you've got to do it at a certain angle, and you've got to be pointing away from the area that you actually want to get to, because you've also got the current that's underneath you. A fantastic amount of skill is involved in doing all of this. And then you think, and on the top of that, you've got to get alongside another vessel, and you're going to be firing at them with cannon. And you think all these instruments that we've got today, like GPS and satellite tracking and all of that, in order to work out exactly where we are, and we've got our tide sheets and tide tables and all the rest of it. And you think you've got people back then, you know, they didn't have GPS. You know, they were lucky if they had a timepiece and they had a compass. And you think of Captain Bligh, and he didn't, I don't think he even had any charts. He just had to go by memory. And you think you can go back even further to the time of the Phoenicians and the Egyptians and the Phoenicians were able to get all the way to Britain to pick the tin up, to take that back to Phoenicia. There was an Egyptian-type ship, I think, that was found off Yorkshire that was 2,000 years old. And they had this skill of navigating and using these ships. And it's always been a white man's skill, and particularly a British skill. Britain was the ruler of the waves, and it features so much in our patriotic songs. And, you know, and that just proves that we used to be the guys that really were on top to beat an army like that. Another thing that it makes me think of there, Max, is how the strategy that's involved in, you've got your enemy ships and they're in one place in a harbour, and then you've got your ships on the outside of it to prevent them from actually being able to get out. And in order to do that, you've got to match the same number of ships, basically. So, and it's almost like today when you've got, you know, one side's got a certain amount of nuclear weapons, another side's got a certain amount of nuclear weapons, and that ensures that there's peace. And back then, you've got one side's got a certain amount of ships, the other side's got a certain amount of ships, and they're both sort of facing one another, and that should hold the peace, basically. And it's these same principles that are used today in warfare, I guess.
Yeah, and after the Battle of Trafalgar, there was an arms race between Napoleon and the British government, where Napoleon vowed, following the Battle of Trafalgar, that he would build a fleet of 150 ships of the line, and so they are these particular kind of battleships. And we responded by building as many ships as we could. I think Napoleon managed to get up to something like about 84 ships of the line, and at the peak, the British Navy was at something like 99 or something like that. And so, you know, we just had to keep constructing more and more ships in order that we could outnumber the French in order to maintain our dominance. And of course, the other aspect was that because we traded with colonies that were across the other side of the world, we had a very large proportion, very large pool of men who were trained as sailors and who could obviously therefore man warships and things, and so and use the skills that they picked up in trade and also in exploration in order to help the Navy win battles that in numerical terms they probably shouldn't have been able to win. And I think that the fact that Nelson used these unconventional tactics in order to win the Battle of Trafalgar is very significant, and it's one of the features of our nation over the centuries is that we've been very inventive in finding new ways in thinking outside the box that's given us the advantage over our opponents or rivals, whether it be in trade or whether it be in war or whatever. It's no surprise then that the agricultural revolution began here in Britain, that the industrial revolution began here in Britain, and that lots of things that have been invented, and I think per capita, it's fairly well acknowledged that our nation has invented more things than virtually any other nation.
It's innovation that sets us apart. In actual fact, it's innovation that sets white people apart. When you look at the Chinese, you think some of these Chinese, they've got a higher average IQ than the white man has, but they don't actually invent things. What they do is they miniaturize things that the white man has already invented. It's white people that have this spirit of innovation and discovery that these other races don't have. As you say, Max, the British seem to have a higher proportion of it than others. If you look back at the inventions and the innovation that we had, and you think this tiny little island, it was known to rule the waves. British sea power was the sea power. And you think you can trace that back to King Alfred, and he was the one that supposedly first built up the British Navy and designed the British boats in order to fight against the Vikings. But as I say, before then you had this tradition of the Phoenicians coming to Britain as well, and it all came together in this massive boat building industry that we used to have that they've now done away with. And Britain used to lead the world in boat building, and it used to have this industry all around the coast. And now all we've got left is this one little bit up there at the top of Scotland. I mean, we're an island nation. Boat building, we should be right at the top of boat building. And it's just not an industry that receives very much help from the government anymore. We don't make use of our natural resources. It should be so simple to prevent people from breaking into Britain, because we're surrounded by this huge moat. I mean, they used to put moats around castles because it would keep the castle safe. And we've got a huge moat around the island, and yet we've still got hundreds of Iraqis and Syrians and who knows what else that are managing to arrive upon the shores. And it should just be a simple matter to prevent them from doing that. I think people like Nelson he'd be turning in his grave to see what is happening to his country today. The man was obviously a great patriot, serving country and serving king, and doing these unconventional methods. Just going back to these formations as well, these formations of the ships. I mean, it was the battle formation that allowed the Romans to conquer the rest of the world. It was the way that they had that formation I forget the actual name of it now, where they had the shields over the top of their heads and they were in a square rectangle shape.
The phalanx.
Phalanx, that's it. Yeah, the phalanx. And it was the phalanx that enabled them to conquer the world. And then you think how, as the shipbuilding came along, they must have worked out, you know, the best way to have these battles was to have the ships, as you were saying, all in a long line, trailing one past the other, firing away with the cannons. And that's now been improved upon, as well. And of course there were susceptibilities to that, as Nelson saw, when you've got people that aren't that experienced. And again, that shows you that it's experience that matters. You can't just put any old person there into a job and expect them to be able to do it. Again, something which they're doing today, just saying that, well, you need to have somebody in there just because she's a woman. We need to have somebody doing that just because they're black. And you don't. You need people with experience. You need people that are in that position due to merit and merit alone. And, you know, I would say that it was not sticking to that which really, you know, caused Napoleon to lose that battle if he had inexperienced sailors there, Max.
Yeah, I think that it's individuality which is a key characteristic of European nations, and I think it's probably expressed more keenly amongst the British than other nations, just purely because we've been on the outside of Europe, so therefore we've been able to encourage individuality, and that individuality doesn't only sort of apply to people's characters in terms of the way that they conduct themselves in life. It's also individuality in terms of thought, and it's individuality in terms of thought that causes people to think outside the box, causes people to invent and innovate, and that's why we've been so good at those things in the past. And it's a shame, really, that one of the features of empires is that there is this temptation to force conformity upon people. And so what we can see with empires that have tried to oppose us in the past, and that we've had wars with in the past, those empires have actually failed largely as a result of the enforced conformity. Because if you want to enforce conformity so that you can enforce your rule over a large number of people, then the requirement is that you chop down the tall poppies, or whatever the phrase is, and you kill off the people who are capable of independent thought and who are capable of thinking individually and innovatively, so that they conform with the orders that are being issued by the central power of that empire. And so this is the reason why the Soviets had such great difficulty in fighting the Germans during the Second World War, and it took a point to be reached where the Soviet army was something like nine times the size of the German army on the Eastern Front before the Soviets were able to push the German army back. And that's just purely because during the communist revolutions, people who were regarded as intellectuals, free thinkers, people who were individualists were carted off to the gulags and exterminated. And that only left people who were prepared to follow orders, but who found it difficult to actually think and innovate for themselves. And, this principle that freedom of thought, freedom of action and individuality are sort of key elements to a thriving nation. And that's something that we should always bear in mind.
Yeah, I was just going to say there, the extension of that, like this empire mentality of getting everybody to conform, at the far end of that, you've got these purges of the intellectuals that happened under communism. And also in Maoist China and in Cambodia, where they were even executing people just because they wore glasses, because they looked like they were intelligent. They got rid of the entire intelligentsia. And then you've got nobody that can come up with this innovation. I mean, what we should be doing, as we talked about last week, is teaching people about their identity, teaching people about their national identity, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, the things that they are likely to be good at, and these great heroes of our past that and whose blood flows within our veins that we can emulate today, and we can reach deep within ourselves into that national spirit and tap into that, and we can succeed today, and people can still do great things today. We just need to know that and learn about it to realize who we really are and what we are really capable of. And thank you very much for that, Max. That was really interesting learning about the Battle of Trafalgar there. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of The Greatest Britons, and we will be looking at the Duke of Wellington.